are needed for a market, they're needed for a supply. And so it's a first step of what could be a long relationship.
The state partners with a Japanese company to work to develop Alaska's LNG market. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 23rd. Good evening, I'm Annie Feit. Also tonight, a look back at the origins of the Endangered Species Act.
I went through the whole bill and took out all of the weasel words, and the net result is a remarkably tough piece of legislation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Alaska Governor Bill Walker today signed a memorandum of understanding with Japan-based Resource Energy, Inc. for liquefied natural gas development and export out of Cook Inlet. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The agreement stems from Japan's desire to branch away from nuclear power in favor of LNG in the aftermath of the massive 2011 earthquake, which caused the shutdown of the Fukushima nuclear plant. Governor Walker says the memorandum of understanding doesn't include many specifics.
It's just more of a cooperation agreement, acknowledging they have a need and we have a need, are needed for a market, they're needed for a supply. And so it's a first step of what could be a long relationship.
Resource Energy is working on longer-term development plans for North Slope LNG, which could come to fruition by 2025. But companies are expecting a market window in Japan before then. So Governor Walker says REI is considering a project in Cook Inlet.
It is a small-scale effort in Cook Inlet to just sort of get something, sort of a foot in the door, get something started, some flow going in that direction.
REI is confident LNG exports from Cook Inlet would be viable. The company anticipates a 1 million ton capacity by 2019, increasing to as much as 3 million tons. REI spokesperson Shinichi Shimizu says the company is looking into the cost and figuring out exactly what infrastructure will be needed at the Mat-Su Valley's Port McKenzie.
We have to build brand new LNG facilities there. So I can't say exactly right now what sort of development we have to expect in Port McKenzie.
Shimizu says the company expects to have a better idea of what will be needed by the end of March 2015. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Humpback whales may be coming off the endangered species list soon. Federal officials are expected to announce a decision within the next few weeks. Regardless of what they decide, one thing is clear. Without whales and other marine mammals, there might not even be an endangered species list. In the first of a series exploring humpback whales and the Endangered Species Act, KCAW reporter Rachel Waltholtz and biologist Ellen Chenoweth explain how one of the nation's most enduring environmental laws emerged from the office of one of its least revered presidents.
Through our years of past carelessness, we incurred a debt to nature, and now that debt is being called.
I'm Rachel Waltholtz.
And I'm Ellen Chenoweth.
And this is the beginning of the Endangered Species Act.
The great question of the 70s is, shall we surrender to our surroundings, or shall we make our peace with nature and begin to make reparations for the damage we have done to our air, to our land, and to our water?
That's President Richard Nixon in 1970 laying out an ambitious environmental agenda.
In his 5.5 years in office, Nixon signed the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and in 1973, the Endangered Species Act.
For those of us who associate the Nixon administration with Watergate and Vietnam, this is a little surprising.
Well, and it would be more so if you knew him.
That's Lee Talbot. He was one of the architects of the Endangered Species Act.
President Nixon was not what one could call an environmentalist.
But he was a pretty good politician, and he recognized that there was this groundswell of public support for environmental action. Remember, in the late 60s and early 70s, environmental issues are suddenly in the news.
When people talk about this era, they always bring up Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring.
Right, and that comes out in the early 60s. In 1969, there's the Santa Barbara oil spill, one of the largest in U.S. history. That same year, Ohio's Cuyahoga River catches fire, becoming a national symbol of polluted waters. The first Earth Day is organized in 1970.
Here's all of the constituents are requesting government to do something about the environment, and the great majority of people in Congress didn't really know what environment was.
Nixon gave his staff wide latitude to pursue environmental policy, and they ran with it. Talbot was a senior scientist with the President's Council on Environmental Quality. He knew he wanted to pass a major endangered species law, but he decided to push first for what became the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
And this is the law that makes it illegal to hunt marine mammals, including whales.
It was evident to me that the public didn't really connect with, say, a cod, but they could get excited about a marine mammal. So it seemed to me that we ought to make a major push on whales, and then hopefully go beyond that later on.
And this was a bill that wasn't very popular with the commercial fishing industry or with the federal agencies. But the main obstacle was actually the Department of Defense.
And can we just pause and note that as recently as the late 60s, the Department of Defense was still using sperm whale oil in its weapon systems?
Right. So the fact that some people wanted to ban commercial whaling was literally a matter of national security.
It turns out sperm whale oil could handle really high temperatures and pressure. The military didn't think they could replace it, but Talbot thought differently. He describes a meeting he arranged deep below the White House between representatives of the Joint Chiefs and folks from a couple of the major chemical companies.
I said, well, is it true that it's not possible to produce this? And they both said, no, we can do it. And I said, well, how long would it take you to get it in the adequate amounts? And one of them said, 2 months. And the other said, 6 weeks.
And the Marine Mammal Protection Act passed in 1972. On to the Endangered Species Act. Talbot and his colleagues had learned from earlier endangered species laws how easily they could be circumvented. They were determined that this time the law would have teeth.
What we did was take the administration bill and I went through the whole bill and took out all of the weasel words. So, for example, where it said the secretary may take some action, I changed may to shall. Where it said insofar as practicable, I just took that out. And the net result is a remarkably tough piece of legislation.
The Endangered Species Act passed the House 390-12. It passed the Senate 92-0.
Ted Stevens voted for it. Don Young was a freshman representative at the time, and he voted for it.
And many legislators, many people were surprised when they found that it, you know, gave all species the right to exist.
That's Joe Roman. He's a conservation biologist, and he's written a lot about the Endangered Species Act.
And, you know, that was what made it so radical and so important.
So there are a couple things that make the Endangered Species Act so powerful. The first is this protection for habitat.
Because the law says you have to protect the species and the ecosystems they depend on, you can't just keep them in zoos. That's really the power of the ESA right now, is those critical habitats.
The other big innovation is including what's called the precautionary principle. At the time, if scientists said harvesting a particular species was driving it to extinction, the burden was on scientists to prove it.
So what I did was rewrite it backwards and put it so that the onus is on those who wish to harvest to prove that it won't threaten them.
So this law was incredibly ambitious. But the question is, has it worked?
If you frame the question, if you judge the success of the Endangered Species Act by the amount of species that have recovered, it's not looking so good. There are only about 30 species of the thousands that have been listed that have been recovered and removed from the list.
But there's also another way to look at it.
If you see the ESA as a law that's intended to prevent extinction, it's been successful in that estimates are that the extinction rate since the passage of the Act declined by tenfold.
It's true that they're still on the list, but they're not extinct. And that's a big factor.
And for that, we can thank Richard Nixon. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And I'm Ellen Chenoweth.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, homeless kids in Anchorage dream about the perfect Christmas present.
A Barbie house that you press the button and then it turns into a real house that you can actually go in. It's a clubhouse.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
A decision by voters to increase Alaska's minimum wage could bring a bump in the minimum that must be paid to the state's school bus drivers. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports a state law passed in 1989 requires school bus drivers to be paid at least twice the minimum wage. The law does not force employers to increase driver pay midway through a contract, but could kick in with new contracts. The state's minimum wage since 2009 has been $7.75 per hour. Ballot Measure 3, approved in November, will increase the minimum wage by $1 per hour on February 24th and by another dollar per hour in 2016. An ambitious project to build a fiber optic cable between England and Japan beneath Arctic waters has been delayed. The project will bring high-speed internet to remote corners of western Alaska, but the arrival of that service has been pushed back until at least 2016. KNOM's Matthew Smith has more.
Canadian telecommunications company Arctic Fiber is running the undersea cable, but Anchorage-based Quintillion Networks is the middle-mile provider, creating several spur lines that would shoot off the main fiber backbone and connect the ultra-fast cable to telecom companies in Nome, Kotzebue, and other communities along the Bering Strait coast and the North Slope. It's commonly referred to as the Arctic Fiber Project, and it promises a big increase in internet speeds throughout western Alaska. Quintillion CEO Elizabeth Pierce says the $650 million fiber line began mapping and surveying this summer. That will continue in 2015, with onshore landing sites being constructed this winter. But she says that's a, quote, small amount of work compared to the next phase of the project.
The major work, the horizontal directional drilling from the shoreline offshore for the spurs, and that's again to, you know, get the spurs coming into the shore buried deep and out of harm's way. That will happen next summer. Then the cable will be laid once those HDD bores are completed for the spur lines.
But the undersea cable to Japan is only part of Quintillion's bigger picture. The company is also tapping into an overland cable set to run from Prudhoe Bay on the North Slope down along the Dalton Highway and on into Fairbanks and Anchorage. That part of the project, now being built by AT&T, has also faced several delays, and until that landline is built or the cable to Japan is laid, Pierce says it's a waiting game.
Our in-service date will be the earlier of whichever one of those connection comes in into service, whether it's the Dalton Highway first, AT&T's built, or whether it's our connection to Japan first, whichever one of those comes in first, that's when we'll be able to turn up service.
Regardless of which connection comes online first, only when the undersea cable is complete will the promise of ultra-fast broadband be brought to the Bering Strait. And while the date for service may be a moving target, it's not changing any plans for local Western Alaska telecoms preparing to bring Quintillion spur lines the final mile into homes and businesses. Steve Miriam, the CEO of the Arctic Slope Telephone Association Cooperative, says the co-op worked with Quintillion this summer to build $4.5 million worth of communication shelters in Wainwright, Point Hope, and Barrow. Miriam says the co-op is confident enough in the project that they're laying out some serious money to get ready.
Definitely has legs. We've got about a $16 million RUS loan in process to upgrade our facilities onshore to take advantage of the fiber connectivity.
No matter how fast the fiber promises to be, the process of getting it built can seem painfully slow to many in Western Alaska. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
A package of sales tax recommendations that could take a chunk out of Juneau's anticipated $7 million budget deficit is headed for a public hearing. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
The committee recommends raising the maximum taxable value of big-ticket items from $7,500 to $14,000, limiting the senior sales tax exemption to Juneau residents, limiting the senior sales tax exemption to food, fuel, and electricity, and limiting the senior sales tax exemption on all other goods to seniors with incomes below 250% of the federal poverty level. The recommendations were made piecemeal. Deputy Mayor Mary Becker chaired the committee and noted the recommendations don't constrain the Assembly's policymaking authority. One proposal the committee did not recommend was raising the age of eligibility for the senior sales tax exemption from 65 to 70 over 5 years. Here's Mary Becker.
I would certainly not personally agree to that because I think it is a double whammy.
She was referring to the combination with the other changes to the senior sales tax exemption.
I think one or the other is fine with me.
Assemblywoman Kate Troll said she saw it as a double break.
They get two good benefits. Instead of eliminating the exemption altogether, we're keeping it on essentials, we're making it needs-based.
Assemblyman Jesse Keel argued that people are living longer, healthier, and many are choosing to continue working past age 65.
And so some limited shift to reflect the realities of the world we live in, I think, is good tax policy because it keeps us in line with the economic realities of our age.
The recommendation, which the Juneau Commission on Aging supported, failed in a 2-2 vote. Assemblyman Jerry Nankervis was the other no vote. Becker says she expects the Assembly's Finance Committee to take up the recommendations after the public hearing scheduled for January 8th. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
For the past 15 years, Anchorage police and firefighters have donated money to the Shop with a Cop program. It gives disadvantaged children the chance to buy gifts for themselves and their family members for Christmas. But as KSKA's Ann Hillman learned, it also highlights a problem in Anchorage: families experiencing homelessness.
A group of police officers and firefighters wait near the entrance of Fred Meyer in Anchorage as dozens of children file in. The adults are about to take the kids Christmas shopping. 8-year-old Lily pairs up with Officer Bonnie Charles, and they push their cart toward the toy aisle.
What kind of toys do you like?
Lily thinks for a bit, glances at her Hello Kitty t-shirt, and says,
Hello Kitty toys?
Hello Kitty? Okay, I think we can find some of those.
Lily is shopping for herself and her three siblings. First, she picks out a Nerf gun for her brother Connor. But as soon as they move to a different aisle of toys, she quickly changes her mind.
Because Connor really, really, really likes cars.
He likes cars?
Mm-hmm.
And then Josh could get that?
Okay.
Many things tempt her, and Lily jumps from one shiny object to the next. She picks out a Barbie pool for herself, Hello Kitty long forgotten. Moments later, she changes again and settles on a child-sized guitar.
I had a guitar once, and then my dad had to put it back because we were running out of food, and then he had to put it back, and then he got a lot of money. Then he could buy food. Yay!
Lily lives at the Salvation Army's McKinnell House with her siblings and their father. The emergency shelter is the only temporary housing that takes in single dads and their kids. It provides hotel-like rooms, meals, and a group playroom and lounge. They also teach classes on financial literacy and parenting skills. Diana Gomez is the administrator of the house. She says families are only supposed to stay in the 16 units for 30 days, but many stay longer so they can save up money for permanent housing.
Our goal is always that they will not go from shelter to shelter, but that they will go to their own apartment.
Carmen Springer with the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness says 80% of the homeless population is only homeless for a short time. The most common reason is the cost of housing. It's higher than most people can actually pay. Other causes are one-time events, like major illnesses in the family or lost jobs.
More people than often like to admit it live only a couple paychecks away from homelessness, and we have a very limited safety net, both here and across the country.
Springer says different programs, like rapid rehousing and rent subsidies, help get people back into homes quickly, and they usually don't become homeless again. She says it's hard to have an accurate count of how many families and individuals are homeless. Some services count how many people they help and report it to a common database. Others don't. And the numbers fluctuate by season as well. Back at the store, Lily finishes her shopping, then thinks about the absolutely perfect gift for her family.
A Barbie house that you press the button and then it turns into a real house that you can actually go in. It's a clubhouse. But it's not real life, though.
In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Juneau Assembly last night honored a city police officer who recently received a statewide award as the top local government employee in Alaska. Then, for good measure, the Assembly recognized the entire Juneau Police Department. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Blaine Hatch is JPD's school resource officer. He runs the DARE program, which stands for Drug Abuse Resistance Education. He's also often the first officer to respond to incidents in Juneau schools.
Officer Hatch is somewhere between a rock star and a substitute parent for so many of Juneau's kids.
That's Mayor Merrill Sanford congratulating Hatch on his Alaska Municipal League Employee of the Year Award. AML is a nonprofit interest group for local governments in Alaska. Its board of directors bestowed the honor on Hatch last month after city officials nominated him. Sanford listed some of the reasons Hatch deserves the recognition.
He single-handedly teaches DARE in six middle schools, runs the junior police academy, and responds to police calls in the schools and assists patrol in his spare time.
When a student brought a handgun to Thunder Mountain High School earlier this year, Hatch detained him and assisted school officials with a lockdown. He's also credited with helping save the life of a man who collapsed at a downtown bar this past summer. But Sanford said it's the little things that earned Hatch's award.
Officer Hatch assisted with security at the prom celebrations during the spring of 2013. A school employee wrote JPD a thank you letter after seeing him vacuuming the entryway of the venue in his uniform just before the doors opened.
After Hatch was recognized, Assemblyman Jerry Nankervis, himself a former Juneau cop, said a few words of thanks to the men and women of JPD.
I know there's been stuff in the press lately that has not been favorable towards police officers. I am a homer, hands down, even in spite of that. This is the best police department in the state of Alaska.
After Nankervis's remarks, the dozen or so police officers and JPD family members at the meeting stood in a line as assembly members and city staff offered personal thanks with a handshake or a hug. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Homer icon Alice's Champagne Palace had its grand opening under new owners Friday. The classic bar and eatery was packed from opening to closing. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver stopped by to check out the new Alice's and has more.
It's standing room only at Alice's Champagne Palace. The room is buzzing with chatter, the dance floor is full, and the band, Blues Troller, is center stage.
I think everybody's just really happy it's open.
Jim House was a fan of the old Alice's, and like many people in town, was sad when it shut its doors earlier this year.
You know, I've only been here for 3 years, but I had heard that it had opened and closed numerous times in the past. And when it had closed, it, you know, came as no surprise to a lot of people. But for a lot of people that came in here and, you know, pretty decent food, a pretty good medium place to go, you know, it's kind of like, oh, wow, they're not going to be there anymore. So, yeah, a little bit of a hit to the community.
That's why he came on this opening night. He wanted to check out the new look and feel of Homer's living room. For months, the community didn't know what was going to happen to this town staple. Would it be closed for years? Be torn down? Then came Dr. Todd Bowling, his wife Beth, and friend Matt North. They bought Alice's, got it licensed, hired a full staff, and renovated, fixed, and spiffed up the old building. North spent most of the night tending bar, mixing drinks, doing dishes, making sure everything was running smoothly. I caught him on a mad dash into the dining room. He says he's very excited to see the turnout and support.
We're very happy to finally see the end of the construction and get ready to start having beer and food.
One member of the new staff is executive chef Ryan Lee. He describes Alice's new menu as wholesome bar food. He says he's not trying to reinvent the wheel, just make it better.
We're serving chicken wings. We have French fries, onion rings, chicken tenders. I mean, we have all the stuff. But we're making our buns from scratch, our pretzels from scratch, our desserts from scratch. We make our ice cream. You know, all our sauces are made. We're not just dumping something out of a can. And so not trying to change the whole scope of bar food, just trying to make it really good.
And he's pretty happy about the feedback he's been getting all night long. The menu seems to be going over well, and Lee says he's glad to finally test drive it with customers.
Really awesome from a chef point of view, where there's a lot of work that goes into it, a lot of preparation, a lot of people building the whole menu, and then to be able to execute it, have everything go pretty smooth. I mean, not perfect, but this is night one, you know, and we had a full house since we opened the door, and that's awesome.
Lee says his kitchen will be supporting local growers and producers as much as possible. For that reason, he says people can expect to see the menu change with the seasons. The seafood is locally caught and harvested, so when mussels bed down for the winter across the bay, they'll do the same in the kitchen. He says Homer tends to be supportive of locally sourced products.
Where if people know that you are supporting local, there'll be people showing up at the back door selling potatoes and selling carrots, and in the summer, all the beautiful greens and edible flowers, and I mean, that's what makes Homer so cool.
There is one more change that I kept hearing about all night long. To find out for myself, I headed into the ladies' commode. That's where I found Marilyn Parrott. She and the other women inside were very pleased with what they considered a marked improvement over the old ways.
Well, back in the day, the women's bathrooms were almost like men's urinals. We did have a partition, but, you know, it was very friendly. And luckily, we're a close-knit community because it made it work. And then we stepped up to curtains, and that was amazing. There was like this privacy that we had never known before. And now, oh my God, we have two sinks, we have doors. It's amazing. It's just insane. It's beautiful. It's so clean and so fresh and so new, and we love it.
And that seemed to be the theme of the night. It's got the charm of the old Alice's, but where it counts, it's new and improved. And judging by the turnout opening night, it's here to stay. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Ellen Chenoweth in Sitka, Matthew Smith in Nome, Jeremy Shea and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.